Hello, everyone. My guest today is Philip Coffins, and he is an investigative journalist and prolific author, and we're going to talk about his new book, The Ancient Alien Question, a new inquiry into the existence, evidence, and influence of ancient visitors. I might add that Philip is also a leading contributor to the History Channel's popular series, Ancient Aliens. So, welcome to the programme, Philip.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Well, I'm very pleased. I have to say, if I wasn't doing what I am now, I have a strong suspicion I would be very much doing what you are, because I've always been interested, ever since a young lad, in the unknown, but of course, from a point of view, we're trying to find out what it's all about. And I would love to do this investigative type of work that you do. So what actually started you on that type of thing?
Well, I was an investigative journalist, mostly interested in the world of politics and intelligence agencies. And it really was a coincidence. I've always, you know, when I was 10 and following history, I remember being intrigued by the pyramids, and I always loved history, which is to some extent why I became an investigative journalist. But the period of time where I was more interested in was more recent times rather than this prehistory. I felt that pretty much history, the way it was written, the further we went back in time, the more, I would say, the more settled, the more accepted it was. And yeah, that obviously has since changed dramatically. But how that happened was that in the early 1990s, I was working an awful lot on Kennedy material. Basically, the Iron Curtain had come down, and Oswald, the alleged assassin of Kennedy, had spent some considerable time in an interesting few years in Russia, Soviet Union as it was then at the time. And with the fall of the Iron Curtain, what really happened was that all of these files of him in Russia had become available. And so it also was the case that he, for example, when he returned to America, he traveled through the Netherlands, and I was living in Belgium at the time. So I was somewhat ideally suited to report on that and follow up some of these leads. And it is at that moment in time, Oliver Stone was doing his big JFK movie, that a UFO researcher, a conspiracy writer called Bill Cooper, basically wrote or said that Kennedy was killed because of UFOs. Now, I had heard about UFOs. I obviously was aware of what they were, but I had never really looked into them. And to cut a somewhat longer story a bit shorter, Cooper really wasn't telling the truth. And in fact, later he would apologize for having told stories which he said had been given to him and which he had identified as being not true either. But whatever, my interest was wet, because really what was happening here in the world of UFOs was this other dimension, this notion that, you know, behind the world of politics is this world of intelligence agencies, but that within those groups there were secret cabals of people who were directing the fate of mankind and denying the existence of ET. So I became intrigued with that, and then, as intrigued as I was, there was a job offer coming, and that job offer basically was to help promote some books abroad for a Belgian publisher, and those books dealt with megalithic civilization and the mystery of Rennes Le Chateau. So that really made me go into a radically different area, and what I soon began to realize was that this alternative field really had some very interesting things. For example, Boval at that moment in time was releasing the Orion mystery. So many things were happening. Hancock had written about the Ark of the Covenant and the Sign and the Seal. And so all of those books were coming there, but they were, those books were great, but there were other books out there who were very bespoke and really information which was tailored towards 100, 200, maybe 300 people, and it really needed to kind of get some reworking before that was possibly to be released to its general audience. And so I began to kind of like look into stories which I felt the audience at large should really be interested in. And so I helped bring about stories like the existence of pyramids in China as they had been discovered or rediscovered by Hartwig Hausdorff, various other things. I really try to bring out to an international audience rather than just being locked up into quite often language barriers or simply an author or a discoverer who wasn't able to bring it out to a larger audience. And so that pretty much started from 1994 to 1995 onwards. And almost 20 years later, this is where we have arrived at.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, it's all the subjects you're interested in are extremely interesting, to say the least. Did you do much work abroad in sort of following up your investigations, or did you do that mainly from sort of what you might call historical reference?
Well, both. Whenever, I mean, an awful lot of the material I feel you have to go to. But there's a bespoke number of subjects where, you know, you can't go abroad to, or you really don't have anything at it. For example, when you're writing an article about Mars, it really, you know, I would like to go there and get a definitive answer, but so far nobody has gone there. So that is very much going through the books. But when it comes to talking about how Chichen Itza is a three-dimensional scale model of the Mayan creation mythology, or when we're talking about latest discoveries of the Bosnian pyramids, or new theories about Stonehenge or Avebury, or things like what is Ranulf Chateau truly about, in all of those cases you really need to have been there and sometimes go there specifically for the purpose of writing an article. Now, when I wrote my book, The New Pyramid Age, a few years ago, I wrote, I think, about 60 pyramid sites, and clearly I could not visit all of them. And in some cases, it wasn't necessary. In some cases, it was like, just reporting on the fact that there is a pyramid there. I think when you are writing about certain things, you always need to, whether it is visiting sites or whether it is researching sites, you basically need to do as much evidence as you feel required by the statements you're making. So, if you're basically claiming that somebody is alive, then a mere mention on Facebook or something like that might just be evidence enough that that person is indeed alive. We all know in this day and age that if somebody is dead, you just can't take it from a Twitter feed, because various celebrities just in the past few months have been declared on Twitter whereas they were absolutely alive. So it really depends on kind of like what statements you make and the extent of the research you have to do. But I would say that mainly all of the research, or most of the research which I'm doing, does require on-site visits. And it's the fun. It's the great thing. Kathleen, my wife, who's a novelist, and I, we constantly say how blessed we are that we can write and visit these places rather than sit in a cubicle from 9 to 5. It's, at the same time, we're saying that we've never taken a week off to just go and sit in the sunshine. So it is a slightly different life, and it's definitely not 9 to 5, but it is doing the things we love doing and seeing the sites we love to see and visit. So it's a good life.
Absolutely. Now, I noticed very recently a quote from the press where the U.S. government replied to an inquiry about UFOs, I think it was, a more particularly contact with extraterrestrials, and they said in effect that there was no evidence of any visitations, etc., etc. Now, but why do you think it is after all this time that they won't admit to the fact that they've had contact, and there is evidence anyway of other people's contacts? But what do you think is really behind all that?
Well, once you've told the lie, it's really hard to get out. And we've seen that, with people such as Richard Nixon or Bill Clinton. And quite often the lie which is made has nothing to do with what actually is being covered up. Now, in the case of Roswell and various other things, it's clear that at some point somebody in the past lied. And then there is this typical government reaction whereby they feel that it is better to continue lying and sometimes, you know, spin ridiculous lies which nobody believes. And but, you know, just in the kind of saying, well, we can't admit it. And that is something which is typical of many people and many governments, that they somehow feel that they are forced to lie. I was born in Belgium, and my members of my family are politicians there. And after a while, in being in the opposition, a member of my family became a member of parliament. And his party was actually part of the government, and a very dear friend of him and a vociferous opponent when he was in the opposition became Minister of the Interior. And after a few months in office, this man basically said in private that being in government was completely different from what he thought it would be, and specifically that on a daily basis he was forced to do cover-ups and close files which he felt he would never close up in his entire life, but that he just had to do this because there were so many factors involved which had nothing to do with the core subject, which basically meant that this was happening. And when you start looking at the UFO phenomenon, things like the Robertson panel in 1952, it's a CIA document. Whether we believe it or not doesn't really matter, but it's a CIA report which suggests that the government should debunk UFO sightings because belief or proof of UFOs and the fact that we're not alone would detract from America's efforts to squat the communist regime and the communist menace. And so you have a government which by default is going to adopt that policy because the red menace was, you know, far more important in anybody's eyes than the existence of extraterrestrial beings at that moment in time. And so you have this combination of reports which suggest that it is better to cover up and derive the phenomenon, as well as the fact that when it comes to Roswell, clearly at some point somebody made a decision to begin to cover this up after initially they were going to go ahead and basically say certain things were found. And once that lie is created, basically you are on a different path and one where it is very hard to come out of. And just when you see how hard it is for governments to apologize, they are very bad at it. People like Bill Clinton try to apologize for some of the secret projects which the CIA was doing sometimes on black homeless people in dilapidated parts of America, some other things which the CIA had done in the 1950s. And at all times, you see how hard it is, if only because people will begin to sue the government. And if only because once a government knows, and this is something what happened with Watergate in the 1970s, when people lose faith in their government, governments fall. More and more things come out. And we quite often think of the American government or the British government as being this institution which will forever remain intact. But, that is by and large an illusion. We have seen great empires fall, and the Soviet regime and Rome is probably the two best examples of that.
Right, yeah. Would I be correct in thinking that the earliest known contact by extraterrestrials with a U.S. president goes back to the time of Eisenhower?
It picks up with, obviously, Truman in 1947 with the UFO era, but I think it might have gone much before that. We see people who in the 1920s and 30s were interested in this phenomenon. I think we have made this this idealistic division between 1947 and anything which happened before and anything which happened afterwards. I don't think it's as clear-cut as that. And I think that however much, you know, we are trying to push certain people into this, I think really it's something which has always been inherent of politics. You know, politics have always covered things up because it's the easier thing to do. You slap a top secret notice on it, or you say that this can only be revealed 25 years after a former president's death, and that's it. So many things are, it is so far so much easier to destroy a truth than to reveal it. And in these corridors of power, the road of least resistance is always taken.
And I think it was a pity when President Carter took over that he had promised, I believe, to reveal what he knew about UFOs because he had a sighting himself, but apparently he was stopped from going any further.
Well, yes, I mean, there have been a number of instances. Barry Goldwater is probably the first one who, as a senator, I believe he was at the time, tried to open up some of the government's information. He tried to go into Wright-Patterson and try to find out whether or not there was something to this infamous Hangar 18, which allegedly contained the secrets of ufology. And he was basically told to go home and never ask that question again. We have seen that, you know, presidents buckle under pressure. We have somebody in the White House today who's probably the best example of this, who rode in on enormous amounts of bravura. And after his first initial briefing with the CIA in November of 2008, basically buckled under that pressure and changed the foreign policy of the American government immediately, because the CIA and everybody else in the civil branch of the government had basically been able to convince him that there was this phantom menace somewhere lurking in the shadows, and that therefore the war on terror had to continue. And all of a sudden, the agenda on which he had rode into office disappeared. So the same thing happened, you know, with Carter. And there have been very good examples, and I think the best ones probably come from the Bill Clinton era, where he, if I remember correctly, visited Ireland, and his school child asked him whether or not, you know, there was any truth to Roswell, and he basically said, if there is, then, you know, the government has kept it from me, myself, as well. And he said it smilingly, but it is something which actually goes back to facts. It is known that, apart from the fact that he read some of the UFO books, he had somebody working as his chief of staff, John Podesta, who also, he might still be part of the Obama White House. He was definitely a part at the early days of the Obama administration. And he is, you know, he had a poster in the West Wing of the White House, which basically had the infamous Skulder, the X-Files poster of, you know, the truth is out there. He wanted to know. He was absolutely convinced of the reality of UFOs, and he had been, you know, he has been in an insider in Washington politics for several years now, and he is still left asking the question. A British researcher, Mark Bilkington, has done a very remarkable book, I think, which is called Mirage Men, and he actually takes you on this trail of the people inside the government, specifically the intelligence authorities, who are there to create this smokescreen, and how on occasion they themselves seem to be confused as to whether they're telling the truth or are telling a lie. And, you know, these people who at some point will tell the greatest nonsense then will absolutely be convinced that even though they don't possess the truth about UFOs, that somewhere else within the government this truth is hidden. And it is a very difficult, shadowy, gray world to operate in. And to some extent, we do have to go to 1947 and Roswell, because at that moment in time, definitely the Roswell saga was far clearer and far simpler than it eventually became. And to a large extent, I think part of the smokescreen and part of the mythology about Roswell, specifically MJ-12 and all of those things, were purposefully created by the government to basically create such a hall of mirrors that nobody ever would wade through it and come out with an easy truth. And so, you know, that is part of the agenda to create a point. A collection of material whereby you know that nobody will ever really know the complete answer.
Right. Now, one of the intentions of your book is to highlight the influences that extraterrestrials have had. Now, apart from, I suppose, one of the more obvious ones where the military has gained a lot of information by back engineering the crash sources. What do you think they have in other respects done to influence, say, our civilization?
Extraterrestrial civilizations influencing us or the military influencing our civilization?
Well, the extraterrestrials, yes.
The thing is that when I started looking into the ancient alien question again, specifically for this book, I really wanted to, you know, to approach this from a very open angle. And so many books on this subject have been written from such a very narrow perspective that I didn't want to go into that path. And to some extent, the evidence simply doesn't warrant some of the conclusions some of these books are reaching. And there is a chapter in my book which basically goes and somewhat exposes the people who are involved in making these wild claims about extraterrestrial intervention and then basically have no evidence to support it. But there is a clear indication from all our cultures across the world that our ancestors always spoke of a time when the gods were here, that the gods were physically present, that they walked amongst them, that they spoke to them, and that they taught them, about the arts, the sciences, that they helped them. And so this notion that mankind in you know, roughly 3000 BC is quite often the date that most historians and archaeologists put on that at that moment in time mankind began to walk this path of civilization, they pretend that this is something which we have always walked alone. And our ancestors definitely didn't believe that. If anything, they say that civilization was a gift of the gods, that they did this together with us in some form of symbiosis, and that we created this civilization together with the gods in their image, that we still have this notion there. And to some extent, the best example is probably the Mayans, who all said that at repeated intervals, roughly every 400 years, there would be basically a return of the gods, who would come back and renegotiate the fate of the world, so that they could help mankind into making this real. And so that is something which you see across cultures, whether we're talking about South America, Middle America, the Hopi, the Egyptian civilization. All of these civilizations talk of a time in a distant past when the gods were present and helped us on this path of civilization. And to a large extent, what that was of course the arts, as I said, sciences, things like sacred geometry and all of those things, but also the notion that, you know, God existed, God with a big G. An awful lot of conspiracy people, specifically the likes of David Icke and to some extent Zechariah Sitchin, they have this desire to identify the gods with the small g who came here, the aliens, as evil, as somehow dominating us. And that is simply, you know, their own thought construct placed on ancient mythology. There is nowhere in ancient accounts to suggest that the gods were evil. When it comes to things like the Bible, there really is no evidence to suggest that the non-human contacts these beings had, our ancestors had, was with anything evil. And so time and time again, we're confronted with the fact that they gave us knowledge, they gave us information. And in the book, I actually make out that this is not something which stopped in the past, that this information from non-human intelligences continues to this very moment in time with the likes of Terence McKenna, who was given time wave theory, this mathematical equation, which the gods told him was the real purpose or the real structure of time, that time wasn't just some side aspect as our modern physicists believe, but that time is actually a fractal wave, and that there is a reason why at certain points in time certain things are being discovered at a far quicker pace, whereas at other moments in time hardly anything new happens. And so McKenna put this in a book. McKenna tried to understand this, and unfortunately we live in a time when very few people would bend over this problem and study it. And this is, I think, the big difference between our times and the past. In the past, when somebody would have come with this kind of information, pretty much everybody who had the brains to do so would bend themselves and break their backs over to try and get the answer as to what these things, these mathematical formulas would be, and to try and understand what time really is. And that is the big difference between our ancestors' attitude and ours. Our ancestors were respectful of the gifts the gods gave us. Today we are less so, and we're definitely less interested.
Right. Now, what are your thoughts about the claim that there were giants in our history who were described as the sons of God?
Well, there is both historical evidence and there's also archaeological evidence. So the historical evidence is, you can find it in the Bible, you can find it in other accounts, Sumerian accounts. So this notion that there once were giants is not something which is that far-fetched. On an archaeological level, I think we actually featured it in Ancient Alien Season 1, maybe 2, when David Hatch Childress went out to Lovelock, Nevada, to a local museum there, and basically showed the remains of what at one point had been 15 gigantic human skulls, since reduced to a far less number because these skulls seem to continuously be lost by the museum curators for unknown reasons. But the Lovelock, Nevada skulls are just one example of a number of incidents where giant humans have been found. Another person who documented some of them was Michael Creamer in Forbidden Archaeology, who showed that apart from giant human skulls, various other things have been found at some point, specifically in the 19th century. An awful lot of mining occurred, obviously, in the 19th century, and an awful lot of this mining activity uncovered things which were buried, and some of these things which were buried were definitely anomalous. And when they were given to the buttoning scientists of that time, they really didn't take an interest in them and basically felt that this was something which they could discard or in some case cover up if it wasn't easy to lose. And so to some extent, Forbidden Archaeology and Richard Rudgley's Lost Civilization of the Stone Age document this idea that so much of our perspective on things which have been found, and we just think that the Leakeys were the only ones who discovered hominoids, but so many other things have been found suggesting that our history and our descendants, our ancestry rather, is far more complex and far more intriguing. And so I like the fact that there is both historical references as well as archaeological references, because both of them really make the case stronger for the fact that there were once other creatures around.
Right. Now, you mention in your book about the Naxa lines in Peru. Do you think that is evidence of extraterrestrials coming to the Earth and setting up some sort of symbolic references that could only be really seen in detail or fully when you were way above them? What's your sort of take on that?
Well, I mean, in the book I make it clear that I don't believe that the Nazca lines are extraterrestrial in origin or are actually made by extraterrestrials, but I do show that they were indeed meant to be seen from above. And when Eric posed his question in 1968, one of 237 questions which he posed in Chariots of the Gods. We were confronted with the Nazca Lines as something which was only defended by a sole archaeologist called Maria Reiki. Nobody else was interested, and the interest which Eric put on the Nazca Lines really meant that they were discovered, that they were researched in more depth. And what was discovered was the fact that the Nazca civilization was far more complex and far more intriguing than anybody had so far realized. Pyramids have been found, mummifications have been found, an entire civilization there, which nobody had thought of as existing there, has really been found there. And so that is largely due to Eric putting the Nazca Lines on the map. Now, what he said as well was that this looked like an airport. He was giving a physical description. When we look at the atomic explosion, we say that it looks like a giant mushroom, and I hope that nobody in 500 years from now thinks that we in the 20th and the 21st century thought there was such a thing as a giant mushroom which could explode. It's a description which he gave. And so, whereas it's now been shown that the Nazca Lines are definitely not landing strips or an airport, and neither has Eric ever claimed that, they are definitely meant to be seen from above. And some pioneering researchers who are studying the Nazca Lines have actually done extraordinary research into that. They have found, for example, that there are places around the Nazca Plateau where there is evidence that hot air balloons were used to take to the sky and see these gigantic geoglyphs from above, that there's also evidence of gliders. In fact, that some people were buried in their tombs with the glider material wrapped around them as some kind of mummification or kind of, the tool, right, whereby the person who was taken to the skies, maybe he might have crashed, we don't know. But definitely that this was his passion, and that therefore in death he had to be identified and unified with his passion in life. So throughout, we really are confronted with the fact that these people did take to the skies, that this is a far bigger civilization than scientists were aware of in 1968. And, Eric will be the first to say that this is all perfectly well, because he's always taken this attitude that he basically, his thing is that history is wrong on a number of instances. He will challenge the historic status quo, and then pretty much, it is for historians and archaeologists to take it or leave it. And basically his line of reasoning is this: when history is wrong, there are two possibilities. One, our ancestors were far more advanced than we give them credit for, and he's perfectly happy with that. Or B, our ancestors were indeed idiots, and then therefore the thing which is clearly of a technological superiority than what we are giving our ancestors commonly credit for is not theirs, and therefore by default we need to look at some outside agent, and that agent is therefore ET. But Eric will tell you that he is absolutely fine if on a number of occasions the answer turns out to be not ET, but simply the fact that our ancestors are far more technologically advanced than we gave them credit for.
Right. Talking of our ancestors, in ancient history and some legends, there seem to be some very strong indications that the deities descended from the skies. In your own investigations, do you think there is any particularly strong proof or indication that was so?
Well, yes. There's a number of occasions in which the gods were sent to come from the sky. Every myth is diverse, and so in some cases they come out of the sky, in some cases they come out of the earth, in some cases they come out of a rock. It really is this notion that our ancestors were aware that there was far more to traveling between worlds, dimensions, whatever you want to call it, than what we're giving our, the laws of physics certainty for or leniency for. And in those instances where the gods did come from the sky, it is clear that, that this was something magical. They descended like birds, and it is also quite dramatic. For example, in ancient Egypt, there is a story of Atum visiting the Giza Plateau, and it is said that on one occasion when he did so, a holy tree which was standing on the Giza Plateau burnt. Now, you know, that's a very physical description of clearly something coming from the sky and something leaving physical damage behind. So this is not just some kind of metaphysical description of some wishy-washy symbolic interpretation, as so many archaeologists and various other people want to make this into. In all instances, what these civilizations were describing was something which was factual on a number of occasions, where it was factual in a literal physical sense, but also in a number of occasions, as I point out in the last chapter of my book, where contact with these intelligences, the non-human intelligences, more than likely occurred in a what I would call a more metaphysical level, a non-physical level, that it really was more communication through what we would probably more commonly call psychic means, but that this at no point diminishes the bond which some of these civilizations had.
Right. Now, in ancient Egyptian history, there is reports that appear to describe what we might recognize today as crafts fighting one another and using advanced weaponry. That was when in the time of Horus and Set, and their gods, as they called them. And there's also, of course, the Indian Vimanas. Now, do you think, as a lot of people do, that they do actually describe events that happened in the heavens that involved aliens?
Well, definitely in the case of Vimanas, it's very interesting, I think. You know, what you're confronted with, there are extremely detailed accounts. Now, it is true, as some skeptics will say, that some of these accounts have been written down relatively recently, some as recent as the early parts of the 20th century. But, you know, simply the fact that they were written down doesn't mean that they didn't exist before. And on a large number of occasions, that is simply the case, that these things had an oral tradition for centuries, if not longer, and that they were the oral accounts of people describing what had happened. Definitely when you look at the way the people of Mohenjo-Daro and Harappa and the Indus civilization of Pakistan, the way they're lying in the street, they're holding hands, their death was imminent. Something, you know, killed these people instantaneously. There was no chance of escape. And so far, nothing has been suggested that this is explainable through some kind of volcanic eruption or some other more mundane reason. So far, you know, these deaths remain not necessarily unaccounted for, but at least unexplained. When you then hear that this is a region where there was an ancient civilization, that this civilization has stories about how the gods once waged war in the sky and that, you know, they destroyed parts of the world, you begin to wonder whether or not there is a possibility, an overlap, that indeed something like that happened. There is one patch, an area in India, where high levels of radioactivity were found, and even though the government and the local authorities tried to explain this away as that somehow this patch must have been to do with the fact that some kind of radioactive material was legally disposed, at no point in time could they actually prove that was the case. And it is just one example of somebody using a Geiger counter and realizing that that area was radioactive. But Geiger counters are not normally part of the established archaeological toolkits. And so if more radioactive measurements were to be taken in some of these more interesting archaeological sites like Mohenjo-Daro, Harappa, and various others, then maybe very interesting answers might one day be found.
Now, I know you're interested in the pyramids, and I guess everybody is interested in the ones at Giza, but I notice you also have an interest in the more recent ones that were discovered in Bosnia. Do you, in general terms, think that ancient aliens or visiting us in perhaps more modern times had something to do with the building of them or the design, etc.?
Largely, no. However, in the case of the Great Pyramid, it is a matter of record that Imhotep said that the way the building techniques were given to him, the new method of construction, which eventually led to the erection of the Great Pyramid, was something which had been given to him by non-human intelligences. And it's a very long story, which I won't do, but it is in the book. Basically, Joseph Davidovich is a French engineer who in the 1970s rediscovered the technique as to how, you know, these giant stones were made. And he is absolutely convinced that the stone blocks of which the Great Pyramid is constructed is not hewn from a quarry, but is actually man-made material, and that this is indeed the technique which Imhotep described, and that, of course, Imhotep was describing a technique which he said he had gotten from the gods. And to a large extent, Davidovich is, you know, one of the most proper scientists around. He is a French national hero. He reinvented a science in the 1970s which had been lost for pretty much 4,000 years. And so that, I think, is a remarkable feat. But when it comes to building pyramids, in the new Pyramid Age, I go into how since 1994, pretty much the entire pyramid landscape has been changed. New discoveries have been made about existing pyramids, and also an awful lot of new pyramids have been found. And this has led to a new understanding. And basically, the overall conclusion I reach in that book is that throughout the world, wherever you look, you come across this notion that the pyramid is linked with kingship, that whoever is in charge built this pyramid as a device to cross worlds, that the king was seen as this contact between his people and the world of the gods, and that it was his duty to maintain this task and this link between his people and the gods, and that an aid or a tool in this was the pyramid. And so that pyramid building was intimately linked with the role of the king as a divine ruler and a contact with the world of the divine. And that is something I think which is interesting, because even if you start looking at cultures who might have cross-fertilized each other, there is always a number of cultures where it's clear that the people arrived at this conclusion on their own. And again, it takes into account what I write about in the final book in the final chapter of my book, The Ancient Alien Question, which is that some of this communication didn't happen in the physical form, that on a number of occasions ET more than likely, if not definitely, was here in a physical format, but that also on a large number of occasions this contact was established through other means, through non-physical means, and that we have around us, across the vast expanse of the earth, evidence of, you know, the tools which were used in establishing these connections. It's just that we either no longer see them or are no longer able to use them to some extent, A, because they have fallen into ruins, but also B, because we have lost the science and the tools and the technology and to a large extent the training and in how to use these buildings for communicating with the divine.
Right. Yes, it's a terribly interesting subject, I must say. I would imagine you could almost write a number of books about the whole subject. But have you, in your own investigations, to your knowledge, found evidence of ancient aliens that might be considered something new? In other words, some original findings that perhaps you haven't found anywhere else?
Well, you know, there's no man is an island, so some of the things which are in my book, some of them are clearly things which are out there. But I think the majority of what is in my book is not known to the public at large. Some people who read every book which appears on the subject might know. But definitely the majority of these things is not. Now, in some cases, certain scoops which I once did in articles have reappeared in this book because simply they are important and to some extent they are timeless. So the notion, for example, that the stone disks of Bayan Karaula isn't something which a British science fiction writer invented in 1978, but instead is something which dates back to 1962, and that there is clear evidence that, you know, there is material which suggests that our ancestors were contacted by these beings who had crashed in the remote Tibetan plains of Bayan Karaula, and that they survived there, bred with the local people, and up until 1947, that there were clearly survivors there, and that to this very moment in time there is a tribe which has dwarfish features, and that these people potentially have. Are some kind of hybrid between mankind and these extraterrestrial beings from another planet is something which really has not been shared in any other book in the English language. So it really it all depends on what your level of uniqueness is. There are definitely several things in there which I found, but not necessarily just for the book, some of these things which are in the book I found sometime before and reported on them.
Right. In your opinion, do you think there are any artifacts that have been found that give a clear indication of extraterrestrials that have obviously, in that case, been on the Earth? Because there are records of some very unusual artifacts, and I know you would be well informed on that because I read that you have had some connection at some time with the Fortean Times, and they used to, in my opinion, excel at picking up all these rather sort of odd stories. But what do you think about that?
Well, I didn't have a connection actually with Fortean Times. I mean, I spoke at their conference and I wrote a few articles for them, but that's as far as it went. But definitely, there's sufficient material out there to suggest that there are artifacts of unknown composition. There's one story in the book coming from a Russian source that I think it's in the 1930s that basically an artifact was found whereby the composition, the chemical composition of this artifact showed that this could not have been manufactured on Earth. It simply was impossible to create this chemical composition on planet Earth. As with so many things, after a number of years in existence and a number of analyses, the object then got lost somewhere in a museum collection. So we no longer have it at our disposal today. But it's definitely a case in point that there are some artifacts out there which are clearly of interesting technology. I always look at the crystal skulls myself. The crystal skulls are probably the best evidence, I think, of some technology which has shaped these crystal skulls from crystal in a manner which really defines how this should be done. We often think that simply because modern people in Brazil and even China are able to make crystal skulls, that it is relatively easy to make a crystal skull, but that's simply not the case. I've been around original skulls like the Mitchell Hedges one and Max, and when you compare those and their complexity to some of the fabrications which come from China or Brazil, with all due respect to the Brazilian and the Chinese men and women who make this, they are very small art-wise compared to what is made specifically, in the case of the Mitchell Hedges crystal skull. These are objects which defy convention as to how they were made. In both Max and Mitchell Hedges skull, it would have taken one person 70 years, day in, day out, of working on this object. Now, that is simply the amount of time It doesn't involve the amount of expertise. In all cases, it was sculpted against the grain, which basically means that if a single mistake is made, then the artist can or has to start again using a large piece of crystal. In the case of the Mitchell Hedges skull, you have a detachable jaw, which somehow was loosened from the rest of the skull and then molded. And when you look at this jaw, even though it's firm, when you look at it, you feel as if it's going to break every, 5 minutes. And for somebody to have done this, as kind of like, oh yeah, let's see whether we can do this. It simply defies logic, because we know today that even with hundreds of people doing this in Brazil and China, nobody is able to reproduce the Mitchell Hedges crystal skull in a format that would pass off as being indistinguishable from what it is today. So an awful lot of expertise has gone into those crystal skulls, and I think in my book, at least, they are definitely amongst the better evidence of the fact that what they are is truly remarkable and of another worldly origin. But I also think that most of the material, which would have been far more easily identifiable as of a non-terrestrial origin, has unfortunately either long disappeared or has been stowed away by people and tribes who really wanted to protect all of this information from being destroyed by specifically Western man conquering their homeland.
That's very, very interesting. I would like to think that in many places across the world there are ancient monuments and statues and buildings which have massive stone blocks. I think there are some that are over 100 tons in weight. And I think when we look back at that, we realise we couldn't really move those today. So do you think that is a legacy to visitations where they've left some sort of technology for us?
Well, definitely it's a legacy to the fact that our ancestors knew far more things than we do today. Just from a complete project management point of view, building the Great Pyramid of Giza is something which we didn't do until the last decade, when we started to do certain building projects in Dubai, specifically the airport. The airport extension. It's very rare to have 20,000 people running around on a building site. An airport by default is larger than a rather bespoke site like a pyramid. So just from a non extraterrestrial kind of ancient aliens component, just looking at the Great Pyramid and the fact that, if mankind built this, the way it was built is on par with what we are doing today, I think is a realization which we need to take and take in. When it comes to moving large blocks, I think, we tend to so often look at the world. And ancient aliens suffer from this in the sense that we tend to look that because we went to the moon on a giant rocket, this is the way they will come to us. Simply because we can only move stones with large cranes and heavy lifters, this is the way aliens would have done this. I don't think so. And to some extent, Coral Castle in Homestead, Florida, is an example of this, whereby clearly Edward Lees Cowan was aware of the laws of physics and used them in a way which shows that laws of physics, the way we currently apply them across the world, are not the only means of using them, and that maybe our ancestors were far more aware of the true laws of physics and how to use them, rather than just throw brute force and labor and heavy machinery at it. I think that's not our ancestors, but also E.T.
I'll have to sort of stop you there, because remarkably, we're getting near the last few minutes of the program. And I want to give you the chance just to tell our listeners your website address and where they can get your book. So go ahead.
Well, my book is available through all places where books are sold, which includes things like Amazon, Barnes & Noble. My website is philipcoppens.com, which is P-H-I-L-I-P-C-O-P-P-E-N-S. That is, of course, my name. And if you type my name into Facebook or Twitter, you will also come to me.
Okay, that's fine. Well, I'm going to have to actually bring the program to an end, give myself a minute or two to announce next week's guest. So I have to thank you very much for coming onto the program. It's such an interesting subject. I think you could have gone on probably for another hour if you'd given the opportunity. So thank you very much for it.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you. Well, friends, yet again, another interesting about his life with a Blackfeet elder from northwest Montana. His book is called Open Spaces, which he refers to as a spirit talk. So that's my guest next week. Thank you for being with me this week. And I look forward to having your company next week. God bless you all. Thank you.